Hello and welcome to a new series of the Tanfield Talks podcast. I'm Michael Walsh, and this time I'm joined by my colleagues Tim Polly QC and Michael Buckpitt. In this episode, we'll be taking a look at the protests taking place across the country. The most recent and high profile is Insulate Britain's obstruction of major motorways and roads, but other smaller protests are taking place on a number of other issues across the country, such as the campaigns against the COVID-19 vaccines. We'll be looking at the interplay between rights of protesters, landowners and public authorities. As you may know, to deal with the Insulate Britain protest, National Highways recently obtained a series of injunctions from the High Court. And recently at the Conservative Party conference, it was announced that the government intends to legislate to make it harder for protesters to travel to the site of demonstrations, participating in so-called protest tourism. So in this episode, we're going to look at the powers available to landowners and public authorities to stop the protesters, and we'll look at the legal issues that arise. Now, it's fair to say that between the three of us, we've probably covered just about every type of protest. Michael, you were counsel in the high-profile Court of Appeal case Canada Goose UK Retail Limited and Persons Unknown. But before we look at that, and what about you, Tim?
I've been involved in cases concerning direct action protest against the inland oil and gas industry, principally the UK oil and gas or UKOG litigation. And more recently, I've been involved in protests against the rollout of the COVID vaccines, rather trying to restrain those protests. The form of protests that I've encountered, obviously there's trespass, but there are other things that are, in many respects, more problematic. So you have protesters deliberately obstructing gates, using lock-on devices, which are devices whereby they sort of attach themselves to each other or to things in such a way that it takes a long time to move them. Obstruction of the highway, slow walking of the highway, where they literally put one foot in front of the other, extremely slowly bringing the traffic to almost a complete halt, but not an absolute halt. Lorry surfing, where protesters climb onto vehicles and force them to stop, thereby obstructing the highway. So there's a whole series of direct action tactics that are used by protesters that people who are subject to these protests are trying to restrain. The UKOG case was particularly interesting because it was being litigated from the interim application to the final injunction, just as the law went through its convulsions, its recent convulsions in this area. What work have you done in this area, Michael?
The first significant case I was involved in against political protesters was called RMC LH Co Limited and Persons Unknown. In that case, Occupy London were staging an anti-capitalism protest in the old Royal Mint near Tower Bridge. Mr. Justice Carr heard an urgent claim for possession on New Year's Eve in 2015. The important principle that came out of that case is that organisations like Occupy London are professional trespassers who can foresee the consequences of occupying prominent buildings and can't just delay matters by saying they need to seek legal advice. They need to anticipate an urgent action will come and be prepared to deal with the issues, and adjournments should not be routinely granted. Since then, I've been involved in lots of cases involving political protesters and injunctions against social media thrill seekers who climb tall buildings and cranes and then post their antics on YouTube and social media. Now, what we're going to focus on in this podcast is injunctions rather than actions for possession. So, Tim, let's start with what happens when a landowner fears that a protest is about to start or indeed one has started.
The starting point is probably to consider the legal basis for an injunction. If you're a private or public landowner and you have protesters on or around your land, or you have some sort of operation which is being interfered with by protesters. So what is the legal basis, Michael?
The starting point is to look at the various torts that are available. Trespass is an obvious one if the claimant or the potential claimant has an interest in the area where the process is taking place, and that can also include the airspace above public highways under the ad medium felum presumption. The other obvious causes of action in tort are nuisance in the general sense, where the behaviour is such that it interferes with the use and enjoyment of land, but nuisance also covers restrictions of easement and access. Other torts are probably more difficult to establish. There's the old tort of watching and besetting. I say the old tort because Mr. Justice Nicklin in Canada Goose questions whether it still exists. There's public nuisance, conspiracy to injure by unlawful means, but again, those are remedies that are difficult to establish and maybe make the any application more complicated than it perhaps needs to be. Michael, are there any statutory remedies?
The three main ones are the Protection from Harassment Act 1997, which makes it an offence to harass or stalk another and provides a civil remedy by way of injunction, restraining a person who's harassing another from doing so. It's quite common for private companies to bring representative actions against protesters who are targeting employees, customers, or clients without naming a number of individuals, although we'll talk a bit more about that a bit later in the context of Canada Goose and what Mr. Justin Nicklin said. Then there's Section 222 of the Local Government Act 1972 that empowers local authorities to seek injunctive relief to restrain a public nuisance. Section 187B of the Town and Country Planning Act 1990 allows authorities to bring a claim for injunctions for breach of planning controls in that act. And listeners will be aware that there's a range of powers for local authorities to restrain antisocial behaviour under the Antisocial Behaviour Crime and Policing Act 2014. So let's move on now and look at the Canada Goose case. Michael, can you tell us a bit about the background and perhaps also a potted history of your experience leading up to the Canada Goose case and other types of protests or actions that you've been involved in restraining?
Yeah, as I said, I've acted in the past for various retailers who have been selling products with fur in them, not necessarily fur coats, but fur trimming and so on. And there's been, as everyone knows, a long-standing objection to that trade. The production of fur in this country is illegal. It has been for many years. Fur farming is banned, but nonetheless, retailers are allowed to sell produced elsewhere. Harrods and Harvey Nichols had injunctions in place over the years dealing with fur protesters, and Canada Goose, the store in Canada in the US, was opening its first store in Europe, which was to be in London's Regent Street. The opening was planned for November 2017. The protesters were well organised and had planned to protest from the outset, from the opening, which that was publicised on the internet, and Canada Goose obtained a without notice injunction in the first instance to try and control the activity that was. The injunction dealt with the blocking of doors, the number of protesters, the use of loud hailers and the like, and also precluded any kind of entry into the store and any kind of assaults or threats to staff and members of the public.
Just tell us a little bit more about the type of behaviour that the injunction was seen to restrain. You said things about using loud hailers, shouting, etc. Just set the scene in a bit more detail. What kind of things were happening on Regent Street?
Well, Regent Street, as you may or may not be aware, is a relatively narrow pavement area outside of the Canada Goose store. There's a main road which runs past it, and the preferred method of protest for the protesters was to block the store. In excess of 100 protesters all standing in the vicinity of the door with banners, with loud hailers, shouting constantly, chanting constantly, and restricting access in and out of the store, both for staff and members of the public. Whilst there weren't necessarily direct threats, the atmosphere was a charged and frightening atmosphere. If one wanted to attend the shop in order to either look or purchase something, you'd have to, I think the word used in the hearing was run the gauntlet and force your way through the crowd.
And so the modus operandi, the protesters, was to stop people from going in the store in the first place, harming the commercial interests of Canada Goose. And you, on behalf of Canada Goose, went to the High Court and obtained an injunction. Tell us a bit more about the defendants. Were they named or were they persons unknown?
The defendants were persons unknown by description, and the description was such that they didn't become defendants unless they engaged in the activity that was complained of. The without notice injunction had a short return date, and on the inter-parties return date, the defendants were represented, and not all of it was contested. The order was obtained at a hearing where only certain parts of it were contested. The main concern of the protesters was the imposition of exclusion zones, because, as I know that Michael, you and Tim are aware, one of the sort of classic protester type remedies is to have an exclusion zone where only a certain number of protesters are allowed within a defined area to carry on their protest. So that was the focus of the inter-parties hearing, most of the relief wasn't actually opposed.
So let's unpack the persons unknown issue a little bit more. We're going to look at it in the context of the Canada Goose case, but there is a longer line of recent authority that listeners ought to be aware of. Two cases of importance are the Supreme Court case of Cameron and Liverpool Victoria Insurance Co Limited, and the Court of Appeal case of Boyd and Others and INEOS Upstream Limited. Now, there isn't time in this podcast to go through all those cases in detail, but they are the starting point if you need to consider the issue. Another very recent case that is essential reading is Barking and Dagenham London Borough Council and Others and Persons Unknown, which is a case decided by Mr. Justice Nicklin. In it, he comprehensively sets out the law relating to injunctions against persons unknown. And extraordinarily, there were 38 local authorities who were parties in that case, who all had their previously obtained injunctions reconsidered. Tim, can you tell us a bit more about persons unknown and how it applied in Canada Goose?
Organisations that are seeking injunctions are not so much concerned with claiming damages for anything that has gone before. What they are trying to do is restrain future behaviour. And the nature of protests of this particular nature is that it can never really be known who is going to turn up at any particular protest on any particular day. There's a large body of people who disagree with, say, the sale of fur products or the inland oil and gas industry, and some of those people will be quite happy to protest in a way that might be considered unlawful. And you can't know in advance who is going to turn up. So the beauty of a person unknown injunction to those who were seeking the injunction was always that it would simply catch whoever it happened to be who was attending the protest and behaving in a way that was considered to be unlawful. The problem is that whilst that is fine for interim relief, on the summary judgment application that Mike made, Mr. Justice Nicklin took the point that persons unknown, if a final order is made against persons unknown, that might catch what he described, or what have been described as newcomers to the action. That is, people who have not protested before, have not been served with the proceedings before, but might find themselves in breach of a final order. And that raises fundamental jurisdictional concerns, because those people will be subject to a final order, not having been served with proceedings beforehand. And Mr. Justice Nicklin and the Court of Appeal agreed, considered that that was, in principle, objectionable.
Michael, can you tell us a bit more about the Protection from Harassment Act order that was obtained in Canada Goose, and also how that interacts with bringing a claim against persons unknown? Did that cause any problems as far as the court were concerned?
At the hearing in December of 2017, which was the return date of the interim injunction, PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, were also represented. They had counsel, and he effectively represented all the protesters' interests. At that hearing, there wasn't any real juridical challenge to the use of the Act. It was really about the scope of the use of the Act. It's fair to say that the injunctions that had been in place in other protester cases, where the Protection from Harassment Act had been used to impose exclusion orders, did mean, on a literal interpretation, that if there were only to be 12 protesters, if a 13th protester joined the 12 and the order was made under the Protection from Harassment Act, then all 13 protesters were breaking the Protection from Harassment Act injunction, and that's an arrestable offence.
Let's turn and look at service of these claims. Tim, are there any issues that arise in relation to service when you're seeking an interim injunction against persons unknown or even named defendants?
Yes, it's a fundamental principle that anyone against whom litigation is being pursued has the right to be served with papers, and consequent upon having been served, has the right then to be heard by the court. The problem when one is pursuing a person's unknown injunction is that one doesn't really know who it is that one needs to serve. So in practice, what people try to do, or what the best advice is, to try and publicise, insofar as you can, the injunction in as far and wide a way as is possible, with a view to trying to ensure that anyone who might be willing to partake in the protest becomes aware of it. The idea being that if there is someone who considers that they are entitled to do what it is that the injunction would seek to restrain, they can come forward and contest it. The way one tends to do that, because one doesn't know often names and one doesn't know addresses, is to use social media, to use email, and to publicise the application to organisations. So, for example, the Highways Authority, when it sought its injunction against Insulate Britain, undertook to email the application to the Insulate Britain website. Now, of course, Insulate Britain doesn't have a corporate personality. It is not a legal person as such. But they were doing what they could to ensure that the proceedings were spread, or notice of the proceedings was spread far and wide. Similarly, documents and the fact of a proceeding should be put on websites, and if there's a site, should be placed on large boards on the boundary fences so that anyone coming to the site is aware of what is going on.
In the Canada Goose case and in the Howards and Harvey Nichols cases in the past, the order, because obviously the order, whether it's an interim or a final order, but with the interim orders, they were actually physically served also on every protester that attended a protest. Security guards, staff at the stores, had a batch of orders, sealed orders, which they would serve and they would note and be able to prove service in each individual case. That had an unfortunate effect on the case itself, though, because by that stage, as Mr. Justice Nicklin said, having served somebody and identified them by way of a photograph or a description, it was then, of course, possible to name them, at least by description. And his view was, and certainly the Court of Appeal agreed with him, that they should then have been joined as a party, even if it was only by a description or a photograph.
Mm. Well, it does highlight the importance of identifying defendants if you can. I was surprised to read in the first M25 injunction that no defendants were named, despite some of the leaders of Insulate Britain appearing on Good Morning Britain and being named in the press. But what we see in the latest order is a schedule with 150-odd people named as defendants in the action, as well as persons unknown.
In practice, it's easier to do that when the police are involved, because when the police arrest protesters, they take their name, they take their address, and that information can then be passed to the organisation that is the subject of the protest. Obviously, at that stage, the protesters that have been arrested, if they are to be parties to the litigation, must be joined by name and address. The problems really arise when you don't know who they are, and that certainly happens when the police are not or haven't arrested any of the protesters concerned. You know, that the police's concern is to ensure public order, and provided public order is maintained, the police will not become involved. There will be no arrests, and you will still not know who is there.
Michael, we focused on the rights of the landowner or the entity that's trying to protect their interests. Can you tell us, taking it from the protesters' perspective, what are their rights? What are they entitled to do?
Well, there's a great deal of authority dealing with the rights to protest, both in domestic courts and in the European Court of Human Rights. What I'm going to do is briefly summarise some of the main domestic cases. They are Mayor of London and Hall, and the City of London and Samedi, which were both cases decided by the Court of Appeal. The Hall case is well known as the Parliament Square protest, which took place in 2010, where several groups set up an encampment protesting against, amongst other things, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, genocide, war crimes, and worldwide environmental issues. And the second defendant in that case was Brian Hoare, who was the well-known protester who camped on Parliament Square for almost a decade. The Smeedy case concerned the protest at St Paul's Cathedral in the City of London in 2011, where there was a large encampment of protesters that occupied land belonging to the cathedral and the public highway adjoining it. In the Samedi case, Lord Neuberger set out a non-exhaustive list of factors that the court should consider, which was recently approved by the Supreme Court in the case of DPP and Ziegler. And at paragraph 39, Lord Neuberger said, "In our view, Those factors include, but are not limited to, the extent to which the continuation of the protests would breach domestic law, the importance of the precise location of the protesters, the duration of the protest, the degree to which the protesters occupy the land, and the extent of the actual interference the protest causes to the rights of others, including the property rights of the owners of the land and the rights of any members of the public. The key takeaway points from the cases, both domestic and European Court of Human Rights cases, is that the courts must balance the convention rights of the protesters, the right to protest, against the rights of the general public to go about their business, and to use the most topical example, use the highway, the M25, motorways, the Blackwall Tunnel. In the recent case of London Borough of Lambeth and Grant, the High Court said the courts must be astute to avoid a situation in which the need to assess proportionality under the ECHR becomes a de facto license to the trespassers to occupy public or private land. So the key thing for any protester opposing an injunction is that they have the right to protest, but they might not necessarily have the right to protest for the length of time that they are protesting or on the particular land in question. There's a European case called Appleby and the United Kingdom, which deals with this in a private land context. And in that case, some protesters were handing out a petition at a shopping centre. And the court decided in that case they were entitled to exercise their human right to protest, but not on the private land in question. They could take their protest elsewhere. The land itself was not integral to their protest. But to take a different example, it may be said that if, for example, protesters are protesting against fracking and they occupy land in which it is proposed that fracking will take place, that land is integral to their protest. And so the courts will need to balance their right to protest against the landowner's right to have possession of it.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. I mean, in my experience, certainly the protesters place great importance upon the location of their protest. If there is a site or a location at which something to which they object is happening, they consider it important to stage their protest there, outside the shops, for example, which are selling fur products, outside the sites at which fracking is taking place or drilling is taking place, conventional drilling. And certainly in my experience, the courts are sympathetic to that view that the protesters ought to be entitled to stage their protest in a place where it can properly bear witness, I suppose, to what is happening and what they regard as wrong.
Let's have a quick look at highways. Tim, could you tell us what can a landowner do using the Highways Act to obtain an injunction?
It is a criminal offence by reason of Section 137 of the Highways Act 1980, willfully to obstruct the free passage along a highway, and this is the phrase, without lawful authority or excuse. So that's what needs to be proved by the prosecuting authorities if they seek to prosecute for that offence. On the other hand, it is absolutely clear and has been stated in numerous cases that the public have a right to protest on the highway, and as has been explained in this podcast, any interference with that right must be proportionate. So there's something of a logical circularity here. And in the recent case of DPP and Ziegler, the courts have explained how that circularity is resolved. The case concerned a protest against the arms industry. There was an arms fair taking place at the Excel Centre, and some protesters blocked one of the roads leading to the centre with a lock-on device. They were removed by the police, they were arrested, they were prosecuted. They were initially acquitted by the district judge, but they were convicted on the DPP's appeal to the provisional court, and the protesters appealed their conviction to the Supreme Court. Now, at the Supreme Court, the case turned on legal arguments concerning the proper test for an appeal against acquittal, and it turned on findings of fact made by the district judge. But the Supreme Court clarified that a deliberate obstruction of the highway, and therefore of the public trying to use the highway, may be a legitimate form of protest. There's no principle that the highway cannot be obstructed as a form of protest. And therefore, in balancing the competing rights, the Supreme Court clarified that if the prosecution was not a proportionate response to the protest, that is, if the prosecution breached the protesters' human rights, then the protesters would be regarded as having had lawful excuse for their obstruction within the meaning of the statute, and the acquittal would have been correct. On the other hand, if, in the balance, the conviction was regarded as a proportionate response to the protest, then the protest would have been without lawful authority or excuse and will have been a criminal offence. So the criminal offence, whether the criminal offence is made out or not, piggybacks, as it were, upon the balancing act that takes place between, on the one hand, the public's rights to use the highway, and on the other hand, the protesters' right to use the highway in order to protest. Now, on the facts, as found by the district judge, most importantly, that there were other routes into the Excel Centre, the Supreme Court allowed the protesters' appeal against conviction and restored the acquittal. And that case was earlier this year, and I suspect that is one of the reasons why Insulate Britain protesters have adopted obstructions of main roads as their means of protest.
That's very interesting, isn't it? Because lots of people are extremely angry about the motorways being blocked, and we've seen on social media and in the news very upsetting scenes where, for instance, recently LBC recorded a woman trying to reach her elderly mother in Canterbury and was trying to pass through the Blackwall Tunnel, yet she was being blocked by Insulate Britain protesters. There's an urge to stop that kind of protest, but at the same time, as you've just described, Tim, there is a very fine balancing act to perform, and the Supreme Court has reiterated that, haven't they, in DPP and Ziegler?
That's right. I mean, and that is at the heart of this problem. I mean, as long ago as the Tabernacle case in 2009, Lord Justice Laws was saying this: rights worth having are unruly things. Demonstrations and protests are liable to be a nuisance. They are liable to be inconvenient and tiresome, or at least perceived as such by others who are out of sympathy with them. So that is something that the courts value and protect. On the other hand, there must be balance. And in Ziegler, of course, the balance was perhaps that there was another way into the Excel Centre. If you're blocking the Blackwall Tunnel, you either have to go to the Dartford crossing some time away, or one has to head into the centre of London and use one of the crossings there. So maybe the balance was too far the other way in that case. But this is a difficult problem.
Sometimes these protests work, though, don't they, Michael? I mean, what happened in Canada Goose? Do they still sell fur?
Actually, it's fair to say, whether it's because of the protests or for other reasons, but Canada Goose no longer sell fur in their products.
So let's say that we are approached by a prominent retailer tomorrow and they say, we've got protesters outside our store. What's your toolkit? What are they going to do? What's the first thing that they should, or anyone advising them should do, Michael?
Well, the first thing you'll tell them is that they won't be able to stop the protests because, as we've said earlier on, people have a right to protest. So I think first thing is manage expectations. The next thing is to focus on what relief is achievable. And in my view, you will get a trespass injunction if they're coming into the property. You can stop that. It's your property. As regards what's going on outside of the door, the very best you're going to get is some kind of order that allows for beyond that. I think one is going to struggle to get very much in the way of relief. What do you say, Tim?
I think I'd agree with that entirely, that the best you're going to be able to do is to get an order that tries to manage the protest in such a way that the protesters can continue with their protest in a visible and meaningful way, whilst at the same time the organisation which is subject to the protest can continue with its lawful activities. I think that the courts are generally reluctant to make exclusion orders, so it's about trying to achieve some kind of balance. You have to put some real thought into how you are going to phrase the injunction, because an injunction, given the seriousness of the consequences for its breach, must be phrased incredibly clearly, so that people are under no doubt what it is that they are not permitted to do, and therefore what it is that they are permitted to do. So you need to think about what it is you are going to ask the court to do. and you need to ensure that whatever it is you're going to ask the court to do, it properly strikes a balance between the competing rights.
Michael, whilst Tim and I have sounded perhaps slightly negative as to how much one can achieve nowadays, if you've got particular individual protesters who are aggressive to staff on more than one occasion, do you think there's still any scope to use the Protection from Harassment Act?
Yes, I do. And I think that the important thing, looking at things from a practical perspective, the important thing for claimants to do is to gather evidence from an early stage. Because it's all well and good just going off to court and saying, my staff are being harassed. And you put that in a witness statement, perfectly fine. The court may well be inclined to accept that evidence. But there is nothing better than videos of this happening being showed to the court. Photographs of particularly intimidating conduct occurring. And if you can show the court by way of a video what is happening outside our hypothetical store and how it's obstructing access to it, or it's causing users of the store or the property to think twice about going in, the court's going to be more sympathetic than if it's simply put in a witness statement and the court's being asked just to accept what it is that is being said.
I agree with that. The courts have said in the past that there is the world of difference between persuasion and compulsion. Protest, lawful protest, which the courts will facilitate, is all about persuasion. Compulsion is not about persuasion and is not the sort of protest in principle which the courts are interested in protecting. And the sort of behaviour that was discussed just then, sort of threatening behaviour, threats against staff and so on, that is not the sort of protest that the courts will be willing to protect.
The government has now said that they want to reform or legislate to stop these types of protests. One thing I wonder is whether the answer is, if they do want to make it easier, is to amend the Protection from Harassment Act so that they can bring a representative action on behalf of the public at large or users of a motorway and only allow for that power to be used with the permission or at the instigation of the Attorney General. And then a power of arrest can be attached to the injunction, and that's the way to stop it. But again, that balancing act would still need to be performed. Every case will turn on its facts. Michael?
Where I think we are now, certainly as regards private enterprises, individuals who wish to deal with protesters, in Canada Goose, the Court of Appeal said the following. They said, Canada Goose's problem is that it seeks to invoke the civil jurisdiction of the courts as a means of permanently controlling ongoing public demonstrations by a continually fluctuating body of protesters. It wishes to use remedies in private litigation, in effect, to prevent what is seen as a public disorder. Private law remedies are not well suited to such a task. It's all very well to say that, and it's true, but where one ends up, and this was the concern of Canada Goose and made clear to the Court of Appeal, is that a private entity can use self-help at the end of the day. You can use self-help to some degree, as long as you don't commit offences. And it seems that where we are now is that the civil courts will not really give you the same relief that historically you could have applied by self-help, and that can't be a satisfactory state of affairs.
It is also worth mentioning, isn't it, that even if you do obtain an order from the civil courts, enforcing it and giving that order teeth is an excruciating process. Breach of a High Court injunction is a serious matter, but in most cases, it is only enforceable by way of proceedings for committal, for contempt of court, for breaching the injunction. Can you imagine with the backlog of cases in the civil courts, not even to mention the criminal courts, how long it would take to commit for breach of the M25 injunctions?
In practice, there's another issue too, which is the reputational effects of being seen to pursue those sort of committal actions. Many of the organisations that are subject to this protest just want to get on with what they are doing. In every case, what they are doing is lawful, even if the protesters regard it as, for some reason, objectionable. And the organisations look to an injunction because they hope that it will make the problem go away. You are right, of course, that if people are willing to break the injunction won't make the problem go away unless the organisation concerned, the claimant who has the benefit of the injunction, is willing to proceed with committal proceedings. And quite apart from the length of time that takes and the expense involved, the organisations concerned will be worried about how that will look to the general public. And ultimately, if for whatever reason they are not willing to proceed with committal proceedings, then one wonders what the point of getting the injunction was in the first place.
Yes, committal proceedings aren't an easy option, but the reality is, and certainly in my experience, is that most people comply with injunctions. So if you have an injunction in place, the majority of protesters respect it if they're served with it. Yes, you may have one or two, but I think the mood music now with the courts is those one or two, if they are breaking an order, they will have been named, they need to be named, and perhaps one can obtain a committal against the one or two. But the days of even considering trying to commit a large number of people are long gone, I would suggest.
Well, I think that's the right point to leave our very interesting discussion. I'd like to thank you for listening, and my colleagues who've joined me, Michael Buckpitt and Tim Polley QC. Thanks for listening.